4.6 billion.
The Earth forms.
Cambrian.
542 million.
Complex life explodes.
Permian Triassic.
251 million.
90% of species die.
Cretaceous Tertiary.
65 million.
Meteor kills the dinosaurs.
55 million.
Primates appear.
2.3 million.
Pleistocene.
200,000.
Humans appear.
20,000.
Agricultural
250.
Revolution. Industrial Revolution.
60.
Great Acceleration.
The Anthropocene.
Welcome to Generation Anthropocene, the program where we ask the question, what does it mean to be living in the new geologic age? I'm your host, Mike Osborne, and today's interview is with scientist-turned-lawyer Michael Wehra. Stay with us.
My name is Jens Lundsnee, and I'm a master's student in geology here at Stanford, and I'm here with Michael Wehra. Michael is a professor in the Stanford Law School, as well as a research fellow in the Freeman Spogli Institute Program on Energy and Sustainable Development. Before becoming a lawyer, Michael earned his PhD in ocean sciences from the University of California at Santa Cruz. His research focused on past changes in the Earth climate system. Welcome to the show, Michael.
Thanks for having me, Jens.
First of all, could you tell us a little bit about your PhD research?
Sure. I worked as a scientist on trying to understand the interaction between the ocean and the atmosphere in the tropical regions. So what we think of as the effects that we feel here, we think of as El Niño, La Niña, that sort of weather system, ocean and atmosphere system. And I was trying to understand on long timescales, quite long timescales, over millions of years, how that system has evolved and what the interactions are between the tropical climate that occurs in the Pacific and the Pacific region and the broader global climate, because that area, the equatorial Pacific, is really kind of the heat engine for the planet. And so it would make sense that there could be relationships, interesting relationships between that system and how that system has evolved through time and the broader global system. What I would say that sort of take-home message from the work that I did as an ocean scientist was to say that this system can be in states that are very different than the current one. So there are multiple stable equilibria of the tropical ocean atmosphere system. That's one way to look at the work that I did. So it's possible that we could switch from one state to another, you know, that we could sort of cross some threshold and have the system evolve maybe gradually, but also quite possibly very quickly, given the nonlinearities in the system today, to something that looks very different. Certainly, the models predict changes, and the models predict that those changes in the tropical heat engine are going to have big impacts in the subtropics where we live.
So does your background in paleoclimate give you any greater sense of urgency to the work that you're doing now and to the idea that climate change must be prevented?
I'd say it influences it in two ways. One is to understand that the moment that we're in right now is one that is relatively unique and gives me sort of a deep understanding of the fact that we're at a very warm moment in time before we even start changing climate. So we're sort of perturbing the system in a direction that it doesn't naturally really want to go, and where most of the organisms that live around us really have not evolved to be able to thrive in. The other thing I would say, though, is that my work in paleoclimate has made me very cognizant of how changeable the climate is, right? That climate has varied dramatically over at least the last million years, last million years, 1.8, 2 million years, and through the cycles of the ice ages, but that really our human civilization, the sort of normal that we perceive around us, is incredibly recent in that context and has partly evolved as a function of the relative stability that we've had over the last, say, 5 to 10 millennia, right? We had a stable climate coming out of the last ice age, and we invented a whole bunch of things like domesticated animals and agriculture. And really those two things have allowed us to thrive and develop technologically to the point where we're now maybe destabilizing the climate. But we should both recognize that in a geologic sense, climate is unstable, but also that we have not thrived until the recent interval of relatively stable climate.
I've got to ask, why did you switch to law then? After you were published, I believe, in Science and Nature and a variety of other places for your PhD research. A lot of scientists would love to have that kind of momentum starting a career. Why switch to something else right away?
What I would say is that I tend to be someone who's willing to make big changes, to start out on new things, because I think you learn the most when you're new and when you're doing something that is new and not necessarily the familiar old thing. And I also had a strong feeling, you know, I got interested in this, in the kind of science that I was doing, in this questions around climate, because I care about climate change. And I think it's a really important issue and one of the central problems confronting human civilization right now. So I got interested in the science and worked hard on the science for the better part of a decade, but ultimately felt that, I think as many scientists do, that the basic questions around climate change are settled, right? We know that emissions of greenhouse gases are going to cause warming. There are important questions about the magnitude of warming and the regional impacts, but we know that we are changing the climate. We have been changing the climate, and we're going to continue to change the climate to a much greater extent if we don't change behavior. And behavior is where the really open-ended questions are. How do we change people's behavior? How do we change patterns of economic growth and wealth creation in ways that don't disturb planetary rhythms? And I think that is a much more open and unresolved question than any of the issues I was engaged in for my PhD, and ultimately for me a more interesting question.
After you've done the switch to law, has your general broader opinion about what the U.S. or the international community should do about climate change, has it changed in a broad sense?
Yeah, I would say it is. I have a much more nuanced view of what we should or should not be doing about climate. The big change for me has been coming to terms and really, really coming to grips with the issues of development that interact very strongly with climate. It's one thing to say what the U.S. should or should not do about climate. It's quite another to say what the Chinese government or the Indian government should or should not do about climate change, because we're already rich. We already, you know, we're sitting in one of the an amazing creation of a developed economy, right? The modern research university, and all of the students that attend this university, yourself included, are provided with this incredible opportunity that their parents couldn't have dreamed of, let alone their grandparents or their great grandparents. But when you're talking about a Chinese peasant who has for generations toiled in sort of a subsistence agricultural lifestyle, and the question for them is, should they do something about climate change, or should they try to ensure that their children go to some approximation of Stanford, right? The answer is, I think, a much more complicated one, and that's the question. How to resolve that dilemma, I think, is ultimately the harder question about climate change, and that's the one that I didn't really appreciate as a scientist.
Do you ever miss science?
Sure. Yeah. You know what I miss? I miss the kind of science that I did was sort of it was sort of hard chemistry. You know, I was doing geochemical measurements in little fossils that live in the surface ocean and fall to the bottom of the ocean, pile up as marine sediments, and I miss the questions and sort of getting answers to questions with data. And I also miss the process of doing wet lab chemistry and making instruments run. I sort of miss the hands-on component of that. And, you know, you don't get that in law. I write and I read and I mentor students, but it's a different kind of work.
Okay, so now switching to your current research, could you give us an overview of what it is that you're doing now in law?
Sure. So the sort of two focus areas or foci of my research right now are the design of emissions trading policies, so cap and trade, and the regulation of the energy sector in the United States. And so in the emissions trading regime I've focused a lot on how to implement cap and trade programs successfully. And there's a big difference between kind of the economic theory of those kinds of programs and actually getting them right in practice. The basic questions I've been interested in revolve around what happens when you actually implement these regimes. Because I'm convinced by the theory, by the sort of high level economic reasoning, but there's a lot that can happen between that 30,000 foot view and the rubber actually meeting the road. And we've had some pretty negative experiences with markets, in even environmental markets or energy markets in this country, where manipulation has occurred that has really undermined the theoretical objectives. So early on, I got interested in the development of the emissions trading markets internationally under the Kyoto Protocol and did some work there. I've been involved with, or I was involved with, helping the Energy and Commerce Committee staff on the Waxman-Markey legislation, trying to sort of fine-tune that proposal to make it more effective. And more recently with the Air Resources Board of California, trying to help them with the offset provisions.
So you mentioned having participated in the Waxman-Markey bill in 2009, which was a bill intended to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, and it included a cap and trade component, I believe. So what was the process like of participating in lawmaking?
That was fascinating. I mean, it was, on the one hand, really empowering to realize that you could simply call up your congressperson and your congressional representative and go visit with them. Maybe not with them, but at least with their staff who were working on the issue, and provide input that would actually be, you know, listened to. And I think most people don't realize quite how possible that is. And to the extent that you actually know something about a problem, how staff that are interested in the question will actually organize sort of mini briefings for other staff when you visit. At the same time, it was distressing to realize the extent to which the important aspects of that program or of that proposal were sort of pre-decided in very crude, kind of politicized ways that weren't necessarily in the best interest, I think, of seeing kind of effective policy enacted or certainly implemented.
How so?
Well, just that in the sense that the industries that were going to be regulated played what I think is a disproportionately important role in driving the design of the law. Now, on the one hand, you might say, well, that's entirely appropriate, right? The industries that are going to pay costs should be at the table and should be an important part of the discussion of, you know, shaping the policies that are going to impact them. But I think in this case, you know, there are sort of broader public interests at stake, and I think those didn't always get the attention or the respect that they deserved. You know, I'm not saying that this policy, the bill in question, was necessarily the perfect bill. I mean, I think far from it. But the second point I would make is that I think the process was reflective of a climate in Washington that's highly politicized. And so that was distressing to see, because I sort of come at the problem, or I try to come at the problem from a sort of fact-based, sort of data-driven, maybe because of my science training approach. And that isn't really how things play out in Washington. And I think in many respects, the bill became a hostage of some of really partisan maneuvering, particularly in the Senate, that was unhelpful in the end.
Yeah, it seems like law and science actually have a number of similarities that I could kind of point to. You know, taking it back from the legislative process a little bit,
yeah,
just maybe in academic law or even in practice, that both lawyers and scientists depend on evidence, and there's a lot of arguing over the evidence, and hopefully that the decisions or the conclusions should be made based on a preponderance of that evidence. But there are, of course, important differences where lawyers are, they're responsible to their clients, whereas scientists are hopefully anyway trying to reach the truth with what they're doing. So I was wondering if you see any sort of similarities, differences between science and law from your experience.
I think they're quite different. There's much greater prospect for scientists changing their mind than there is for committed advocates to a particular perspective having their minds changed in the sort of legal or in the policy arena. You don't see too many ideas that really die in the policy arena, unfortunately. You know, even when there's a lot of evidence to suggest that they aren't terribly effective. So it does – I mean, I think there is a difference. You know, and actually I saw this in Washington. It's the other – another interesting kind of wrinkle of that experience was just the extent to which experts are paid. You know, I was offered substantial amounts of money to author reports on various aspects of climate policy, in particular to write reports about in favor of carbon taxes. And I think carbon taxes are a good idea. I don't think they're necessarily a bad policy proposal. But I wasn't going to take money to say something, to lend my name and Stanford's imprimatur to. And what was ironic was that I ended up testifying on panels before various committees with people who took the money from the exact funders who approached me, right? So I said no. This particular organization went to someone else who said yes. And that person ends up sitting, giving expert testimony to lawmakers, pretending as if, you know, pretending that this was their idea, that this has nothing to do with a financial arrangement that's been made behind the scenes. And I find that, you know, I think that in particular gives you some clues to why ideas, good or bad, don't die in the policy arena. And that was definitely an enlightening experience to me.
Along those lines, what do you think is the proper role of a scientist in policy debates? Should scientists be activists when they really care about an issue or when they know more about the issue than anyone else? Or does this risk discrediting science and making it appear politicized?
This is a really complicated issue. It's one that I've thought a lot about, you know, in particular with respect to some of the things that some of my former colleagues say and say very publicly. My own view is that scientists intervening in the policy process work best when they partner with people who understand the policy process. So let me give two examples. There's a scientist at Scripps Institute of Oceanography named Ramanathan who has done a lot of the fundamental work to understand black carbon and emissions of how black carbon impacts climate. He has partnered very successfully with David Victor, who is I think he's a fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's on the faculty at San Diego and is really an acknowledged expert on climate policy, to write a number of editorials that I think present the science and the policy in a very sophisticated manner. I would contrast that with what Jim Hansen has done, where he sort of goes it alone. And I think Jim Hansen knows the climate science better than, you know, pretty much anybody. He's first in class when it comes to his understanding of climate dynamics. However, he is not an expert on, for example, natural resource policy in the United States, and he may not always know as much as he should about the subtleties of oil and gas extraction. And so it's you know, when he treads on that terrain, he's speaking more as a citizen than average citizen, a very intelligent one, well educated, but not someone who's really expert in that area. And that I think is a less successful approach. So I guess my feeling is scientists need to be careful when they stray out of the area where they are really expert, just like everyone should.
You kind of touched on this earlier, that there are some models that are better than others for reducing carbon. And I was wondering if there were any that really stand out for you as good models for either the U.S. or the international community that may or may not have received attention.
One thing I would say, I think, you know, there's a fundamental problem with the international discussion right now. For a long time, the international negotiations have centered around crafting one single big agreement, like get the big deal that will solve the problem once and for all. And if there's one thing that I wish we would try more of, it's smaller scale agreements where we actually do things, where we experiment with reducing emissions from a, you know, of a particular gas from a particular industry, and then we learn about how well we can implement those kinds of programs, how much they actually cost, not how much industry and environmental groups say they're going to cost. And we also learn about our partners in the international negotiation, right? How much we can trust them, how well they can actually implement agreements that they sign on to. And I think that if we could have more sort of small-scale steps, we could actually get a lot further than we've been – than we have been by trying to craft this giant kind of global once-and-for-all agreement. And when you look at the really successful international treaties that are out there, you know, one I would point to is the Montreal Protocol, amended 6 times, I think, and very much a gas-by-gas, industry-by-industry-focused agreement. Another might be the trade negotiations, which have gone through multiple rounds where there were small-scale agreements that worked and then were expanded upon, where the level of commitment was intensified. And I think that's a better model for crafting solutions to climate change, because we really don't know how to do it. We don't know how much it's going to cost, and we don't know whether to trust the people we're negotiating with. And so the real problem is how to develop more information and more trust. And we're not going to do that by going to meetings in far-off places. We need to actually do things in the world that reduce emissions.
So there's been a longstanding debate between people who think that big environmental problems will be solved by innovation versus those who think that human behavioral change is going to be is going to cause the major solution. And, of course, a whole spectrum of positions in between. What do you make of that debate in general, and do you fall within it somewhere?
My basic answer to that sort of question is both. We see environmental problems being resolved by regulatory approaches that change behavior, change incentives. And we also see oftentimes environmental problems being resolved by innovation. But sometimes the innovation is stimulated by the regulation. So it's hard to disentangle behavioral change from the options that people have about how to behave. And to some extent, those are a function of technology.
Will that mixture change if a given environmental problem increases in severity, say climate change, again, like if that really progresses to a more desperate state, do we have to err more on the side of regulation at that point?
Well, let's be clear. We're not doing enough of both right now. We're not doing enough of either approach when it comes to climate change, right? We have energy research and development investment in this country is pathetic. And it needs, you know, it had a little bit of a shot in the arm with the stimulus funding. But really, that money was more oriented toward deployment rather than basic R&D. And we need some basic innovation if we're going to really change the picture on climate, because we do not have right now the suite of technologies that would allow us to be rich and create wealth at the same time as we avoid altering the climate. If we had some kind of an environmental disaster associated that we could really pin on climate change, which is a little bit tricky because it's hard to pin any one environmental disaster on climate. But let's say we could, you know, or let's say that in the popular consciousness, right, there was a connection that's made, which is ultimately more important. Not really whether it's in terms of driving policy change. People need to believe that climate costs something. If that were to happen, you know, the history suggests that there would be a greater regulatory response. That regulatory response probably would lead to more investment in research and development to find new solutions. So they're tied. I mean, that's the history.
Michael, thanks for coming on the show.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me, Jens.
Thanks listening to this episode of Generation Anthropocene. We want to thank all of the students and subjects who contributed to this project. And you can find the full-length interviews at our website, stanford.edu/group/Anthropocene. Thanks to Maserati for letting us use their song Monoliths. A very special thanks to co-producer Tom Hayden for feedback, guidance, and inspiration. Thanks also to Julie Kennedy in the Earth Systems Program. And thanks to KZSU Studios Stanford, where all of our interviews were recorded. History is accelerating, and you're a part of it too. Where would you draw the line?